Those are really great comments. Anna, do you want to come back up and you take the podium and maybe I'll just sit here and...
Sure. Yes. Should I start by just responding very quickly?
Stand at the microphone only because that way we can kind of keep you on. We can, like, podcast this.
Cool.
So it would kill us if we didn't. So.
Yes.
Go ahead.
So I'm going to start with the second question and then maybe address both of Edgar's final questions, and thank you so much for the comments. They were great, and I'm so interested in looking at it from this other kind of combined perspective. And then maybe I'll address the question and then open it up. So in terms, I think that a question that a lot of people who have turned to trying to understand affect ask themselves has to do with methodology. Like, how do you know, right? Like, it's an epistemological question, right? How do you know that you're interpreting something right? How do you know? And I think for a long time, the reason why social scientists were stepping away from even dealing with anything related to affect was the perceived methodological impossibility of it. Not that there is like a definitive way of studying a lot of other stuff, but for some reason, affect felt like particularly inaccessible in some ways. And whenever I think of like, so do we do something different? I don't feel that that is a matter of adding a new methodology to do something different, but rather to change the lens through which we engage methodologically as we already do. So it's like almost like a reformulating of how we do ethnography at all levels, from the conceiving of the project and what it means to us and the role we play, our positionality in terms of class, in terms of race, in terms of geopolitics, in terms of all sorts of things, to the very outcome of the project, shifting the lens through paying attention to the visceral, to the discomfort, to what is inaccessible because we cannot have a certainty that we got it right, and to also using methods that triangulate those. I mean, it's not a matter of just not being empirical. Actually, it's very empirical in many ways. In terms of John Jackson's authenticity and sincerity comment, that's one of the parts of his book that I actually love the most, that distinction. In the past, whenever I've studied authenticity, it had to do with strategic approaches to it. The fact that people, especially in the case of Puerto Ricans, right? I mean, it's that kind of thing of how are you a real Puerto Rican, who is the authentic Puerto Rican and who isn't. And because the Puerto Rican population, you know that half of Puerto Ricans live on the U.S., in the U.S. and half live on the island, there's a continuous kind of assessment of who's authentic and who isn't. In the case of affect, I think that that's something that we need to be explore more. Like, in which ways do we assume that there is a genuineness to what is conveyed? And in what way is that used in a more self-aware or even deliberate or strategic or even political way, which is one of the questions that I still have that I hope to pursue in the next project. But I know that we're kind of running out, so I just want to open it up and see if people have questions.
Do you want to take a few comments and then you can respond?
Okay, sure. Yeah, that sounds good.
That
yeah.
Yeah.
I don't understand what you're talking about, racial democracy here, because you separated Brazilian and not American and not Latinos, if I understood. It's the Puerto Ricans are Latinos and the Brazilian is separate, yeah? It is the first part of the question. But I give you an example. In this country, for racial democracy is pressing in public institutions. I give you, for example, public universities, colleges. They try do like teaching science, mathematics, for example, by African American people. 50%, I would say, like this, and white people 50%. We know.
Wait.
Formally.
No one's following you. You gotta like come up with like just let us know what your point is, and so we have other people to talk.
My point is, in basketball will be on other side. In basketball, be pressing on something, be more teachers from, but we have something like genetic predisposition in music, for example, or jazz. It's just like most African American classic music, white people.
Okay, wait. Okay.
And my question is simple. I don't see in this situation any racial democracy, but institution oppressing for this type in society. And this is a nonsense in many situations.
Okay.
Yeah?
Good. So let's take a few more questions and then you can answer.
Okay.
You can kind of look at the terrain.
Right.
So that's good. Thank you. Do we have another question? Questions?
Yes. It's a fascinating paper and very interesting what you're doing. I'm struck as a linguist by the fact that your source of evidence for emotions is only one.
Mm-hmm.
An intonation. Mm-hmm. And so how can you be empirical? Mm-hmm. It's your judgment of what that's your judgment. How do you, this is the problem, the issue that Marvin Harris years ago tried to address.
That's not where I thought you were going to go.
Right now.
Okay.
Trying to get out of this judgmental, intuitive, subjective evaluation of people's speech by having a number of graduate students watch the same behavior without any language and telling what was happening. I think the students learned a lot from the attempt, actually. And he thought that the subjects were not aware of the camera.
Okay.
And at Christmas time, one of the men turned around and raised his glass to the video and said, "And Merry Christmas to you too, Mark."
Right.
So it's clear that presumption on his part wasn't valid either. But how do you get over that?
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. I think that a lot of what we get to comes from language, both verbal and nonverbal. But I don't think all of it is. I mean, I think that a lot of it is also different kinds of interactions and different kinds of experiences of being in place as an ethnographer and as the same tool of research. And I think that the difference would be that this is not like that kind of confined project in which I would only focus on some people's reaction to others, but rather, you know, it's something that developed. That's why it took 10 years. It's something that you are continuously questioning, right, whether you assess something right. And there's ultimately not 100% of security in this or in any other form of ethnographic materials that we get, but there are ways of trying to access or at least trying to be attentive to expressions of that kind of discomfort, of that kind of interest in conviviality, of that kind of overwhelmness, both when people tell you about it, but also when you sense it. I mean, and it's like, I don't know, I mean, it's weird because on the one hand we say there's no way of knowing, but all of us go through spaces experiencing things. Oh, like this is not safe for some people. This is safe. This is upscale. This is not. You know, and we have done a really good job at kind of avoiding those kinds of assessments and perceptions. So, you know, it's not a perfect way of getting to them, but it's like an intervention in that direction. But
I think if you think about it, it could get better.
Can we take a few more questions?
Yeah.
Right. I'm curious, what about the Upper West Side, or who on the Upper West Side sparked your interest?
Well, I was interested in parenting. I was, believe it or not, when I typed socialization to race and parenting, there was not one study in the pages and pages and pages that dealt with white parents raising white children.
You don't
and teaching race to white people, white children. There was all sorts of, there were people who had adopted kids from other parts of the world and that kind of socialization. There were kids who were mixed race. I mean, socialization is kind of like a huge subdivision within sociology. And the fact that you cannot find that, it's just, it was weird. That was, on the personal level, I've always wondered, I live in Harlem, but my son goes to a daycare by Columbia. And some parents that I run into are from the Upper West Side. And for me, there was something definitely visceral and weird in my encounters that I just wanted to explore more. And I think it was something very specific. I mean, people say that also Park Slope, that is like the hyper-parenting capital of the world, and there are others. But so I just want to explore that a little more in terms of how do people socialize to privilege. And I think that Ipanema and Condado are two other areas that have a very specific way of in which that happens. So I just want to map out the parenting, start by mapping out where parenting happens in those sites.
I wanted to ask you if you could say a little bit more about gender differences and maybe age differences.
Absolutely, and that's I'm so thankful that you brought that up. I mean, I need to first explain that I was very surprised by the fact that the discussion of African Americans was so tremendously gendered. But I think that in part that is the nature of the project, and I think a lot of that has to do with the method of the project. I began my project by focusing on two high schools, and from there I branched out. So I began focusing on one high school, the population of one high school, including parents and teachers and students, in the Ironbound, and one high school in North Broadway. And from that perspective, it began very much as a youth perspective that then branched out into workers because these young people, after 10 years, had already moved into these jobs and so forth. So it is not, it does not encompass a wide generational scope. From the perspective of Latinos and Brazilians. It does more from the perspective of African Americans. I did work with a lot of older African American women and also younger kids. But yeah, but there's definitely a limitation in terms of how that would play out. In the case of Brazilians, especially not only generational in terms of age, but the fact that this is a newer, relatively newer population. So many of them were not US born. So there's like that US born versus immigrant. In the case of gender, I also noticed, and this is something that for some reason happened more in this work than in the work that I've done before, that I did end up being in circles that were very women-centered. But even in cases where it was a more mixed context, the perceptions of otherness were very, very much talked about in terms of gender. So I rarely heard stuff which completely amazed me on black men. Like, I mean, I thought that I would get more stuff on black men. I heard more on black women. I heard stuff on black lesbians. Lesbians in general. It was a very much queered perception of Newark population. The perception that there were like these gangs of lesbians or these lots of lesbians in Newark, that was something that dominated. In the beginning, I would just brush it off. I'm like somebody would mention, oh, just a lot of lesbians. I'm like, oh, whatever. You know, like some people would just say whatever. But then by the time that you hear it five times, you're like, wait, what is this about? Right? So there was more of an interest in exploring that. And so men didn't come into play very much. So.
Thank you. This is a fabulous paper and it's thought-provoking. And it's so fascinating just how that you're like translating brains to different communities together because it seems just so obvious that more people should be so thank you. But I was just really struck by the multiple scales or levels that you're working through. Some of them really effective and like considering both like corporeal and like relational, but then also looking at how that interfaces with both these different scales of both racial ideas and institutions, both like home cultures and US culture. And so I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about kind of both your methodologically and specifically relating to that, because it's you create different ideas are racial worlds interact.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like it's murky in practice.
Right. Yeah, no, that's yeah, it's definitely very, very much so. I think that in part, when it comes to the levels, it was very intentional in some ways. I mean, like, at first, I felt like when Edgar mentioned how people in the humanities have dealt with affect, I did not intend this work to be about affect at all. And I stayed away from it as much as I could because I didn't want to, because my image of what it was much more only at the micro level of just everything is captured in, you know, like this absolute, precisely, everything's captured in language. And I didn't want to go there. And it was the kind of thing that eventually I could not resist it anymore. So I began from a perspective of trying to explore from a very classic urban ethnography kind of perspective, but always with the awareness that there was something more going on. And it was through the exploration of what is that something more that is going on that we're not defining at the level of the classic urban ethnography that this other scale started to happen. And I don't know necessarily that it's like scales as I would put it, because I think that the affective is actually playing in throughout, like from the ground through the immediate, the everyday, through the conceptions of racial democracy as a, you know, transnational ideologies. And the other way around too. I mean, I think that they both feed each other. I don't think that you can talk necessarily about affect. I don't know if I'm completely committed to it, but I don't think that you can talk about affect without really talking about this kind of political economy and social structure that lies within it. Maybe to different degrees here and there, but I don't think that you can totally let go of that.
We probably have time for one or two more questions or comments. Connie? I know you do, I can tell. What's that? Would you like to? I felt like I saw you maybe wanting to make a comment.
No.
Oh.
I'll wait.
Okay. Other people? Other comments?
I pursue this a little more because it is so fascinating. I think one other issue that maybe it should be in the corner is that you speak all the languages that are being used, English, Portuguese, Spanish, in a variety of dialects. And the old turn of the 20th century approach to ethnography, where you just hire a translator, wouldn't get you very far with this, because all the affect lost in the translation.
Mm-hmm.
So it means it's a new approach to ethnography, and it adds new requirements to the ethnographer's bag of skills, which may be then interpreted as you have to be a member of the group to study it. I don't know that it's that so much as you need to have control of all of these systems.
That's interesting, yeah. In terms of like having to be a member of the group, I don't know, like, which one do you get more from? Honestly, like, I feel like I almost got more from, I mean, like, because I was very much, like, I very much felt that people felt that I was more of a member of, I'm Puerto Rican, so there was, like, this kind of claim to that from the side of Puerto Ricans. But I think in that you also lose stuff, right? Because people assume that you know stuff, so there's less articulated, like, less, you know, and maybe there's less need for it. I don't know, but that in the case of Brazilians. And I think that because I wasn't Brazilian, that actually helped me tremendously with Brazilians, which is weird. Like with Puerto Ricans, I always feel like it helped me being Puerto Rican. With Brazilians, I actually felt that it helped me not being Brazilian. Like everybody, like people would be like, oh, you're not. So that's kind of like open. I mean, there were like a lot of issues of competition and who, you know, presentation and performance and that maybe didn't, I don't know. But that's interesting, like, in terms of, like, could you do this in terms of a group project where some people would be the experts in a group or others? Or?
I think it takes a lot of skills, a lot of new skills.
Mm-hmm. To that.
Don't often worry about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't want to take a linguistics course. I'll just hire a translator. I'm an interpreter. And you get very distant kind of ethnographies.
Mm-hmm.
But actually being a member of the group has these other issues that if you may lose stuff, that people assume you know that you don't. So we have to consider, so again, context. We have to consider ourselves and what identities we bring and what the group that we're considering receives as that identity. Mm-hmm. The fact that you are lighter skinned,
right.
White.
Yeah, although nobody ever said that I was white. I mean, neither one of those groups, not, you know. Like, yeah, I mean,
but
yeah.
You would have to expect that it could. That could be an issue.
Mm-hmm. We probably have to wrap up.
In the past, we didn't think this was necessary.
Right. That's true.
We have
two questions, and then we'll have to end because poor Daniel wants to go home. So.
Since folks are making comments,
wait. First, oh, behind you. Yeah, sorry.
Hi, I'm Hal. I've been just a couple of words, I've been putting one of you from in here. I'm always dealing with this issue of cultural affirmation and racialization, and where that comes up with culture. I was fascinated with your speech therapist bringing up. African Americans in Brazil and African Americans seeing it, approaching it in kind of a Pan-African way, Brazilians seeing it as kind of cultural patrimony or something. And that conflict. And then with the schools, when you're talking about, it seemed like we're talking about cultural affirmation of Puerto Ricans as a response to racialization. And then another was wanted to promote cultural affirmation through karate, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you just had anything more to say about expressive culture, music and dance, as an effective response to racialization, or just how that works.
Right. No, that's a great question. I mean, one of the things that you mentioned in terms of the capoeira issue is precisely that even these Brazilians that were exploring the possibility of practicing or engaging in these expressive forms of culture, samba, they themselves did not, I mean, this is not something that they did where they were in Brazil for most of them. For most of them, the trouble was that it questioned their authenticity, the fact that they themselves may not have been able to dance samba. Most of the Brazilians that I work with were from Minas Gerais, the central state. They were not from Rio. They were not from Sao Paulo. There were, but their reconceiving of Brazilianness happened in those global terms, even though they themselves probably would have been considered backwards or rural or what, you know, not from the cool cities type of. So the fact that they themselves were not that close to those expressive forms of culture had an impact of their own conceptions of authenticity, and the African Americans in this perspective were challenging that even more by saying, you know, you're not part of this. You're not the authentic Brazilians that do this. So that's like how it worked out in the case of Brazilians. In the case of Puerto Ricans, I mean, like there's something that happens when you're not a nation, and that this is something that I always talk about with my friends who are from countries who are actually nations. Like they don't. You know, they're like, okay, but I never see somebody who's from India or from Brazil or from anywhere, I'm fine. Whereas Puerto Ricans, like, if you see each other, like, in Turkey, you're, like, going out. I mean, there's something about the performance that you have to continuously perform the nation for it to exist. It's not something that you can take for granted. So I think that those kinds of expressions of culture take on a different kind of meaning in terms of asserting a nationality in very concrete, very political ways. That have a lot of different kinds of meanings in terms of belonging and generation and language and who speaks Spanish well and who doesn't and how do you, you know, what generation are you? Were you born in the U.S.? What is your contact with the island? So I think that for Puerto Ricans, there is that political, embedded political statement with every cultural expression that feels very, very deep. Or maybe I'm just like, assuming that it is like this because I'm Puerto Rican, and so I feel that they're really deep, like deeper than anybody else's. but I don't know. I mean, I just feel that there's something about having to prove that you're a nation, that you exist, when you don't.
It's happening with Bomba more recently, the past
right.
Or so, where Bomba is very much an expression of implementation of it.
Right.
And it's becoming global.
Right.
And yet at the same time, it's got this very strong connection to the rest of the Caribbean, to the
right.
diaspora. And so, you know, mm-hmm. of the people that you know, does that, you know, is that a mark against its Puerto Ricanness, or is that a mark of this very expansiveness?
I think it's a very generational thing, because I remember, like, in terms of the kids, for instance, in high school, when the beginning of the project, when I was focusing only in high schools, there was that joke about how parents could not make their children wear anything folkloric for a dance. Like, that was not considered cool. That was not their Puerto Ricanness. That was just backwards. That was not... But then a lot of people said that they had felt the same way when they were in high school, and then they became practitioners of bomba or plena groups, actually in Newark more than bomba, but later on. So I don't know at what point there might be a very strong generational component in how people approach these forms of cultural expression, especially when it has to do with expressions that you have to know a lot of the history to really appreciate fully. I mean, the fact that there is a very strong Afro-Caribbean connection, that there is a very strong history behind the, you know, the production, so.
And there's this post-folkloric culture, I mean, that's kind of what's going on. We don't need to dress a certain way. You can come in street clothes and do your thing.
You know, I didn't encounter that in particular in Newark. I think that there was that association with the folklore, and I wonder, I don't know where your site is, but I think that there's something very unique about New York that a lot of people, you know, I just feel like whenever I'm even talking about race relations in Newark among people who are very, like New York ethnographers, it's two worlds that are so different, even though they're so close. But
that's a methodological issue. If you have some rudimentary comfort with the language that you're trying to understand, the fact that you're an outsider might allow you to enter into a kind of student-teacher relationship.
Mm-hmm.
People are teaching you.
Absolutely.
But you don't know.
Exactly.
Precisely because you don't know. And so you can profit by their willingness mm-hmm. to show you how it works.
Absolutely.
Both emotionally as well as...
Absolutely. Yeah, and the opposite is true, too. The assumption that you know. When you really don't. I mean, the assumption that you know because you're Puerto Rican and it's like, our, you know, completely, right. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to formulate this. My name is Jeff Fish. I'm a psychologist, and back in the 70s, my wife was an anthropologist who studied the Chinkachi Indians in Brazil.
Oh, wow.
And so I was setting up a graduate program to decide to so I train therapists, and so it seems to me they'd be pretty good street therapists, comparing to the American therapists.
I have some of the American therapists I know.
If there were time, I would give you a good therapist. A couple of comments about race. First, I can't resist mentioning that I recently published an e-book and paperback to make it easily available to students called The Myth of Race, which has a blurb by Wadi Smedley, and which includes a lot of material comparing Brazilian and American conceptions of race. And I was struck by your descriptions. And it seemed to me that was how Brazilians would have to see their role here. You know, Brazilians say that one of the proofs that Americans are racist is that we call people black who aren't black. And it's such a different world that they come from, where you have, you know, in the South anywhere from maybe a couple of dozen up in the Northeast to maybe well over 100 different categories that people are placed in. So one part of it is the difficulty in, you know, people who aren't black becoming black when they get to the United States and trying to understand that. Mm-hmm. And then a second, just a brief incident while I was living there. I met a fellow who considered himself black, and who had learned to say black is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him what that meant. And he said it means black is beautiful too. And so when you come from that kind of self-image, then it's very hard to understand how anyone would be militant or in other words, the way they would expect someone who looks a certain way in the United States to act in Brazil is so different from the way they act in the United States that there's a feeling that there must be something wrong with them. They're not quite happy, right? So just, I guess those were... that's my comment. I don't know if there's a way to respond to this.
Do you have a question?
Something that I thought of thinking for one of you, but my question is better, basically. The why and how you chose, did you choose that your site as in Europe? As you mentioned, like, probably the situation in Europe is very different.
Mm-hmm.
Why? So, why did you choose Europe? I don't want to put the migration in Europe in the world right now. However, that I want to ask you, what areas attract you?
Okay. Okay. Yeah, so let me just make a quick comment to your comment, and then I'll... yeah, I mean, I think that you're right, and but I also think that there's been a convergence in terms of how people play out this. I mean, I think that there, through transnationalism, we also know now that people in Brazil, there's been, through the affirmative action, the quotas, I mean, there's been different kinds of policies in place that have actually forced, to a degree, self-identification in ways that are very similar to how they are happening in the U.S. And likewise here, I think people are slowly kind of integrating this idea of multi... And people have argued this before, like there's more of a multicultural kind of assessment. But yeah, but I mean, I think that ideological, those two kind of paradigms are always put against each other. In terms of why Newark, did you mean why Brazilians in Newark versus Brazilians in the U.S., or do you just mean Newark as a city, or...?
Yes, Newark as a city. Yeah, and also, well, speaking of Brazilian, you might be finding that, for example, speaking of Massachusetts, I don't know the exact name of the town, however, I heard that there is a very big town in which there are a lot of Brazilians.
Oh, yes, definitely. Boston, Framingham, or Danbury, Connecticut. There's many, many towns that used to be, many of them used to be Portuguese enclaves. Yeah. In terms of why Newark, I mean, it was very simple. I lived in New York. I've lived in New York since 2000. I had lived in New York before also, but I lived in New York since 2000. I was working at Rutgers, New Brunswick. And I would always take the train that goes through Newark. And I don't know why I have like a very, talking about emotion, like I have a very like strong reaction to factories for some reason, like especially empty factories. It's just like, I don't know, like, but whenever you go on the train, it's just like really, there's something about them that you project on what life was like, right? Or you know. And I remember thinking, and I've always been very interested in cities that have had racial conflict to the point of national prominence. So when I was in Chicago, that was one of the things that kind of drew my attention, and I had just done my research in Chicago. So Newark was appealing to me for those reasons. I always felt also that New York... was very exceptional rather than the rule, and yet people do so much research in New York that it's almost like New York becomes the standard when in reality it's the exception. So I really was convinced that I wasn't going to do New York, and actually I have never done research in New York other than the one that I'm thinking of, which is one third of it will be here. But yeah, so that's it was just that.
Our last question, I think, is from you.
Thanks.
That's it.
It's not.
I wrote that. Sorry. Connie wants to make an announcement, but let's close this down.
Okay.
Sorry, I forgot I should have done that earlier. So,
thank you so much.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.